Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because I'm speaking with the author of a fascinating book, a really important book, just published by Cambridge University Press in 2023, titled Redefining Ceasefires, Wartime Order and State Building in Syria, which does a number of things. I think perhaps from my point of view, most importantly, the book really examines ceasefires. What do we mean by them? And perhaps more importantly, what should we mean by them? What should we better understand about what a ceasefire is, how it works on the ground, using the case study of Syria to examine all of these complexities? So I'm very pleased to have the author with us today, Dr. Marika Sosnowski, has joined us. Marika, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for the invitation, Miranda.
I'm glad you said yes. Before we dive into the book, though, would you mind introducing yourself a bit and explaining why you wrote this book?
Of course, sure. I'm a research fellow at Melbourne University at the law school there at the moment. I'm based in Melbourne. So in Australia, we usually start anything that we do kind of in a public way by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the lands where I am, which is the Wurundjeri people. And I think that's, in the work that I do on conflict, that I feel like that acknowledgement is really important just to center my own thoughts and hopefully the thoughts and feelings of the audience in terms of how conflict and state violence affects civilians and people. And that's a thing that definitely comes out in the work that I've done for my book and that I want to really center that in my work. This book and this research came about, started in about 2013 when I was working on a development project actually, which aimed to support what was then called the moderate opposition in Syria, develop systems of governance in the north and south of the country. And we would talk to Syrians that were part of that project who we were setting up courts, we were setting up local governance initiatives like local councils and police services and stuff like that. And we would talk to Syrians about how those initiatives were going. And they would say, they're going great until Assad comes over and bombs us and then basically everything falls apart. So that got me thinking that if there could be a ceasefire for a period of time, how might those local governance initiatives develop further? And so that was the kind of the question that spurred the research for the book. And it was kind of a basic question, but then obviously, like any good research project, that got very much problematized and made much more complex when I started to look into that empirically in the Syrian case.
Thank you for giving us that introduction and background. It's always really helpful to kind of know how people come to books, and very not surprised to hear that once you started, things evolved from there. Can we start, I guess, with not just context about sort of how you came to the book, but sort of context about ceasefires more broadly? Why do we need to redefine what we mean by ceasefire?
So ceasefires, until fairly recently, have only really ever been considered as a way, well, primarily as a way to stop or halt violence for a period of time. That's basically the modus operandi of a ceasefire. And I mean, a lot of different ceasefires, and we're seeing that in the Gaza conflict now, they're kind of called a lot of different names. They can be called a humanitarian pause or a cessation of hostilities, or might be called a ceasefire, or what else have they been called, like a humanitarian truce, or, you know, all these kind of different names. But basically the idea behind them is the same, and that is to stop violence for a period of time. But what I found actually in my research was that while they might do that for a little while or for a longer period of time, a lot of other things go on within that space that the ceasefire creates, what I call like wartime order that the ceasefire creates. So those things that happen in that space that I found are things like local governance or rebel governance dynamics can be reconfigured in different ways. Rights to citizenship and property can be changed and challenged, and then dynamics normally considered the purview of the nation state, like diplomacy and security control, they can kind of change and be rearranged as well. So, yeah, so there's a lot more to ceasefires other than just stopping violence, basically.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, I've read the book already, so I know how this plays out in the examples we're going to walk through. But before we get into the case study, is there anything further you'd like to say about how you define ceasefires?
I think the way I'm trying to define them as this sort of particular type of war or a renegotiation or a particular moment where order is renegotiated and that things can happen within that period of order. So basically trying to broaden what people think about when they think about what is a ceasefire and what can it affect, basically.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense. I mean, it sounds so sensible, right? but that's why we need the book to kind of make that claim and go, hang on, let's really look at what this looks like in practice. So I'd like to turn to that bit of the book, the case study section, if you don't mind. Why the Syrian civil war as your case study to examine what a ceasefire is?
Sure. So, like I said, my work in the development sector was quite a lot on Syria. So that's what got me interested in using Syria as a case study in the first place. And I think Syria is a really, or the Syrian revolution and the subsequent civil war, it kind of combines a lot of elements that have become part of modern warfare, I think, in a way. So it's got, you know, it's an internationalized conflict where it's got lots of different actors involved, you know, Russia, the US, lots of different Arab states involved. It's, you know, a lot of targeting of the civilian population, all these kind of different elements that make up the so-called new wars. So I think in many ways Syria has lots of the elements that other wars, so we can use Syria, it's a good example to draw lessons from that we can now apply to other wars, like even what Russia is doing in Ukraine or what's happening in Gaza as well now.
And I think we'll get to kind of how this applies beyond Syria towards the end. But let's go into the Syrian side. Can you talk us through kind of in practical terms, some of the other areas of a conflict that can be impacted by ceasefire? I know you've kind of given us a small example already, but perhaps to kind of make this more real to people, what else are we talking about here practically when it comes to ceasefires?
Sure. So one of the sort of most vivid examples that I can give you from the Syrian context is sort of the rearrangement of citizenship rights. So these happened as a result of what were called initially local truces and then kind of morphed into being called reconciliation agreements in the Syrian context. And these were agreements, basically that were forced on different rebel-held communities by the Syrian regime, often with Russian help or Russian support, and now in many cases just by Russia. So basically what would happen in many of these reconciliation agreements was that a community like Daraya, just outside of Damascus, or Old Homs would be sort of surrounded and besieged by the Syrian regime, and then it would be bombarded until basically the community there had little choice other than to accept the terms of whatever ceasefire agreement was being offered by the regime at that stage. So really they weren't ceasefires that involved sort of what we normally think of as ceasefires, as in like elements of negotiation or compromise, or that they were sort of really beneficial or positive. They were really these kind of strangle contracts that communities were forced into under vast amount of duress. And basically there was a specific term in these agreements that required people in these communities, what was called, what sort of can be translated into English as to settle their status. And what that meant in practice, it kind of sounds quite benign in a way, but what that meant in practice was people that were involved in not just the armed rebellion in that area, but in the political governance of that area. So these could be people from local councils, people that sort of somehow activists that had agitated against the regime, activist journalists, things like that. Everyone in the community had to settle their status. But in practice, if you couldn't settle your status, and basically all those people that I just mentioned, if they tried to settle their status, they would have been arrested by the regime and then detained and imprisoned and all that entails in Syria, which is not a very nice picture. So instead, they were basically forcibly displaced via green buses that your listeners might have seen pictures of, forcibly displaced to Idlib mainly, under the terms basically of these so-called reconciliation agreements. And in that way, they were basically sort of rejected from the state, and their citizenship was called into question based on their perceived or real political loyalty. And basically in Idlib, they don't have any real rights any real citizenship rights vis-a-vis the Syrian state now.
So this brings up the very good point that there are many types of ceasefire, and we cannot just kind of assume that they're all the same and therefore have the same effects. Helpfully, you have created a typology of ceasefires, which is incredibly useful for figuring this out. Can you walk us through it?
Sure. So I won't go into like tons of detail in terms of the different types in the typology, but what I want to say is, it's a 2x2 square framework. So there's four different types in the typology. And I developed the typology through a reading of about 180 or 200 different ceasefires taken from a database of ceasefires compiled by the University of Edinburgh in their PACS data set, and then basically classified them along two dimensions. So the first one was the power sort of dynamics or the power disparity between the parties to the ceasefire agreement and whether that was symmetrical or asymmetrical. And the second axis of the typology was to do with the ceasefire, the text of the ceasefire effectively, and whether that text of the ceasefire had detailed terms or whether they were really vague terms. So I'll just talk it through just a little bit so you get a bit of a better sense. So, for example, the symbolic ceasefires, ceasefires where the power disparity is really symmetrical and the terms are really detailed. So what I call substantive ceasefires, that's just a descriptive name. So, for example, the text of these ceasefires can kind of have troop delineation or, you know, how far apart troops need to be in meters, where they need to be located on certain roads, you know, from what hours they need to be in their barracks, you know. So the text of these sort of what I label as substantive ceasefires is really, really specific in comparison with what I call symbolic ceasefires, which where the text, where the power disparity between the parties is really quite asymmetrical in comparison, and then the text of these symbolic ceasefires is really vague. So in the book, I think one of the examples I give is this sort of a ceasefire that was in the Swat Valley, and where the terms of that ceasefire are particularly vague in terms of kind of I'm just getting the specifics, but it's something like, you know, a Sharia law will be imposed in Swat, including quite vague. The army will gradually withdraw security forces from the region, but that's it. No specifics on, you know, how that'll happen, when that'll happen. The government and the Taliban will exchange prisoners. That's it. So, you know, like you can see just by those really brief examples, like it's quite vague compared to, say, you know, what was the ceasefire in Sri Lanka, for example, which had those much more specific terms in relation to security control and things like that I mentioned.
Got it. Thank you for introducing us to that. This is obviously a good point to mention to listeners that the book obviously has all the detail about all the pieces. So if you're intrigued by the typology and do want all of those details, please go read the book.
Don't let my total brain fade turn you off. So,
could you walk us through perhaps another example? I know I've already asked for a few, explaining sort of how different actors involved in a ceasefire might use the document for their own ends?
Sure. So I'll give you the example of the 2016 cessation of hostilities and how that affected rebel and local governance in the south of Syria, so mainly talking about Daraa province in the south of the country. So what was really interesting about, many things were really interesting about this ceasefire, but what happened was that it was able to reduce violence for a certain amount of time, for a little bit of time, which was obviously the sort of the point of a ceasefire. But one interesting thing that the research showed up was that during this sort of supposed lull in overall violence, what happened was there was targeted assassinations, unsure by who, suspected maybe ISIS affiliates, at least being supported by the regime, but targeted assassinations of local notables, so local sheikhs, local civil society leaders, local, like people in the community that were quite well respected. And this had a real effect on the different communities, sort of a morale effect on the different communities, but in the south of the country. So that's just one small example of how violence during the ceasefire morphed. But in general, in terms of the local and rebel governance in the South, what was really interesting to see is that the ceasefire kind of, it wasn't as simple as that it sort of was beneficial to one party and not to another. It was that the ceasefire created a type of environment, you know, a wartime order that I call it in the book, where different actors in that space, so they included the courts, the local councils, the sheikhs, the non-state actors, so being the armed groups as well, humanitarian actors, as well as sort of financial systems like smuggling routes and things like that. All of those different actors were in some way affected and became recalibrated, or their relationship with each other became recalibrated because of the ceasefire. And, those dynamics were really are really tricky to explain, and I go into that in a lot more detail in the book. But basically the sort of finding and the big takeaway was that not only did they affect kind of rebel governance, which is generally thought of as being by the rebel governance scholars as being kind of solely or primarily related to non-state armed groups. In fact, ceasefires affect them, but they also affect all kind of levels of local governance, really, and how those actors are kind of all related to each other and how those relationships can be recalibrated because of the ceasefire, basically.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm glad we've mentioned wartime order as a key term in the book. Thinking about the state side of things for a moment, you mentioned earlier how ceasefires can be used by the state to redefine citizenship. And as you talked about the kind of settling of status aspect of some of the ceasefires, what about in terms of property rights?
Yeah, sure. I'll talk about property rights. So similarly, in a way, because sort of it kind of runs on from the citizenship argument. So because people were displaced under the terms of these agreements, what happened was that their homes were then, in some cases, like Old Homs being one of them, for example, their homes have now been reappropriated by the regime. That's because of sort of, you know, their titles were not kind of 100% legal in the first place because there's a lot of informal housing in Syria, or it could just be because they've been permanently displaced under the terms of those agreements, and then they either have their title to the property with them, but it's of little use, and or they're not, you know, they can't come back into regime controlled areas without, you know, a massive security risk to themselves. So basically they've got no rights to that property anymore. And what's happened is then that that property has been reappropriated by the regime, or the properties in that area. And then they've been sort of slated for massive redevelopment projects or reconstruction projects as a kind of, which we normally think of as a kind of post-war reconstruction, basically. So in Homs, it's called the Homs Dream Project, which is sort of a large scale sort of, I guess you'd call it a gentrification or beautification kind of project of that area that was sort of once a kind of rebel area that's now becoming kind of become through the reconstruction and the seizure of property, an area that's more loyal to the regime, basically.
Got it. Yeah, no, interesting how those go together. And of course, again, going back to the sensible point right at the beginning, like, of course, if people are forcibly displaced, that has implications for property. But making sure that we kind of include those maybe obvious points in the conversation is really important for kind of what, how we think about this and what the implications are.
Yeah, and I just sort of, just to add to that, I guess just for clarity, I mean, I think it's really important, like, that that specific term of the ceasefire that I mentioned in terms of settling one status, I mean, that kind of effectively facilitates that displacement and then that that sort of permanent reappropriation of the housing, I think. So I think, you know, I do hesitate in the book to draw these kind of like direct causal effects, but I think in that case it's reasonably clear that the ceasefires are what has caused, like, actually this quite gross structural violence. So while they may have kind of decreased the physical violence of the bombing, well, you know, in a way, I think that there was another academic article written about these types of local ceasefires, which where they were deemed like highly successful in terms of reducing levels of violence. And I think, you know, that's really true, but I think that's the whole point I'm making, is that if we only look at them in terms of their ability to halt violence, we just miss a whole massive part of the picture, and that they, you know, yeah, while they may have been really successful in stopping physical violence, the ceasefires themselves have been really structurally violent on these different populations.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And in a similar way, I really find your discussion of ceasefires is kind of connecting up a lot of bits that we don't necessarily connect, right? That idea of kind of what type of violence are we looking at? Also, I think an assumption often that ceasefires are sort of temporary, short term, but then now we're talking about having some really significant long term effects. You talk about in the book that ceasefires bring together macro and micro levels of conflict. And I think we've kind of been dancing around that a little bit, right? You've given us some examples that kind of imply that. Could you talk to this point a bit more about how these different levels come together in a ceasefire?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I talk about that most specifically in the chapter about how ceasefires can affect areas normally considered the sole purview of the nation state, like security and diplomacy. I'm trying to think through like the best example to give you, like a really specific but quite basic example in a way, is that for that case I use the de-escalation zone agreement that was actually negotiated and agreed to by Russia, Turkey, and Iran without the Syrian regime being a signatory to that agreement. But it completely establishes a reality in the territory of Syria. So I found that quite interesting, is that basically the diplomatic control of the Syrian regime was usurped in that case by the ceasefire being agreed to in their absence, effectively. It's unclear, you know, how much or how little the Syrian regime's, you know, their input onto that ceasefire agreement. And that ceasefire agreement effectively set up territorial areas of de-escalation within the territory we know as Syria. And then within those different areas, different things happened, but basically now only one of those four areas remains, because the ceasefire itself enabled effectively the regime and Russia to retake enabled it to focus its concentration specifically on those different areas at different times. And then once it had taken Eastern Ghouta, which is one of those areas, the other two areas of the south and a small area in Homs fell pretty quickly afterwards. Well, they agreed to reconciliation agreements because they saw sort of what the bombardment that had happened on Eastern Ghouta. So the pressure that was the retaking of those areas was effectively enabled by the terms of the ceasefire agreement. So that was like a military a military result, a direct result of the ceasefire agreement. And then in Idlib, security control of that area was sort of completely renegotiated, particularly Turkey's control that it had over that area at that time. That's since changed. That agreement was, I think, 2017 or 2018, and that's subsequently changed quite a lot with Turkey's occupation of the north of the country in the Euphrates Shield area. But basically, Turkey still, or did and probably still to a certain extent, has control or some control or a certain amount of control. It's very unclear over what's now known as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is the non-state group that effectively controls Idlib. So basically there's this kind of recalibration of both state control, non-state armed group control, but over the security control of the territory of Syria, basically, that was kind of enabled by the terms of that ceasefire agreement, which established these four territorial de-escalation zones.
That's, I think, a really key example to kind of make that point of, hang on, there's stuff happening here that's not just about temporarily ceasing or reducing violence. So thank you for taking us through that one. I'd like to kind of ask my next question, I suppose, in two parts. We've discussed sort of the importance of what you're doing here, of thinking through these definitions, of organizing, categorizing different ceasefires, understanding sort of the what the pieces of paper are actually doing on the ground. What then do you think are some of the policy implications of this work that you're doing on defining ceasefires?
I'd like it to have policy implications, and I'd like sort of for conflict negotiators and humanitarians and other people that are working in conflict zones. Basically, I think for me, the lessons are, you know, fairly clear, like I've said to you, and I think like you've taken away from the book, is that basically ceasefires have a diverse amount of consequences. You know, they're not just, you know, I say it in the book, they're not just a ceasefire. You know, and often those consequences are not always, I don't know, often, they're not always at least positive and humanitarian like we often tend to associate with ceasefires. We tend to associate ceasefires, and we see that again in Gaza at the moment with calls for a ceasefire, which, you know, I don't deny that that's a terrible amount of human suffering happening there, and, you know, a ceasefire is definitely at least the best way so far humans have devised to sort of stop that level of violence. But what I guess the big policy implication is for me is, like, don't be blind to the negative effects ceasefires can have, can also have, I guess, you know. And speaking of the Gaza context, for example, I mean, you know, there's been talk already of these humanitarian corridors, or I think they're calling them humanitarian pauses or something like that, that have just been implemented, these sort of four-hour windows that are effectively enabling, you know, forced, again, like mass displacement. You know, I think that probably amounts to forced displacement of people from the north to the south of the country during these kind of four-hour windows, basically. So, again, you see a ceasefire that's kind of, you know, enabling displacement. And I think it's not too unimaginable in that context to sort of see it maybe a humanitarian corridor or something of that nature proposed that then funnels people into, you know, the Egyptian Sinai or something like that, and then creates a kind of situation of permanent displacement for Palestinians. So under the guise of these supposedly humanitarian and beneficial ceasefires, what I want to alert people to is often they have really complex dynamics that can happen under that rubric, basically.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Very important to highlight. For the second part of my question then, essentially the same thing, but instead of policy implications, what about scholarly ones?
I think scholarly ones are what I'd like to, like to see, I guess it's very similar in terms of, I mean, there are definitely more scholars now thinking, which is great, thinking more broadly about the effects these fires can have. So that's one thing. And, you know, definitely beyond the Syrian context is another thing. I'd love to see a lot more of, you know, and I guess that's the wish of every academic to have their work kind of implemented in different scenarios, is I'd love to see other people do really in-depth empirical field work, if that's possible, utilizing the typology and seeing if the categories of the typology kind of hold up for whatever conflict they're working on. That would be amazing, because obviously in the book I only use the typology and relate that to Syria, even though the typology, I should just clarify, is based on a reading of I think over 200 or about 200 different ceasefire agreements that were taken from the PAX data set, which comes out of University of Edinburgh. So that was, the typology was based on a reading of large ceasefires, but the empirical work was really done mainly just on Syria. So it'd be great for scholars, you know, to test that, the contours of that typology in different scenarios that they're working in. Definitely. I'd love that.
And I'd love to read that. So just saying, we've got two people saying, please, let's have that. Obviously, that gives us a kind of lot of things for policymakers to work on, scholars to work on. You've already mentioned a little bit of what you're working on. Would you like to tell us more about what you're working on now that this book is done?
Sure. So, yeah, like I mentioned, I'm sort of thinking a little bit about how this work can be applied in the Gaza context at the moment. And I've like written also a little bit about that sort of lessons from the Syrian ceasefires for Ukraine as well during that conflict. So that's been really, really interesting and really beneficial and really thought-provoking for me to kind of go through that process and to make sure that the research was rigorous enough for it to be transposed to other conflict environments, which I think it is. So that's been really exciting. There's some of that work available online already, in a way, thankfully, not as academic articles, mainly just as blog posts or different things like that. So that's much more accessible for different people as well. But interestingly, there's a couple of other projects I've been working on since sort of the bulk of the research for this book finished. And one which was really interesting and a great sort of, I think, advertisement for sort of in-depth empirical qualitative research was that when I was interviewing people, Syrians with experience of local governance for the ceasefire project, one of the things that they mentioned just sort of off, you know, not direct, you know, it wasn't what the main point of the interview, but they just mentioned it as offhand kind of thing, was that how local councils were registering births, deaths and marriages during rebel control. During the time, so when, you know, areas fell outside state control, these different local councils who were now had no link to the state were continuing to register birth, like life events, basically. And it just got me thinking, like, that's really weird because, you know, usually the state, the nation state, is considered the actor with the sort of sole ability to grant people legal identity, basically. So that was great in that, so really interesting comment. It basically has spurred about 5 years of subsequent research onto legal identity conferred by insurgencies and non-state actors. And that's part of a project I'm just kind of tying up now with Bart Klemm at the University of Gothenburg, funded by the Swedish Research Council on that. And we've got a big special issue coming out with citizenship studies next March with about, I think we've got 13 different contributors on that. So on that issue in varying different contexts and from varying different disciplines and angles. So we're really excited about that. And then currently I've got this amazing postdoctoral fellowship at Melbourne Law School, which looks at it's looking at how people experience the law in the aftermath of conflict or revolutionary events. So again, I think this has sort of been inspired by the work I did on ceasefires, in that I felt I did justice to my interlocutors in the book, and I loved engaging with their stories. But what I really wanted to do with this current project is to go a little bit deeper and to talk to Syrians who I have a sort of quite a deep pre-existing relationship with in a more anthropological way, and to kind of really draw out some of their experiences of the law, both in Syria and then sort of subsequently in countries where they're now finding themselves, or either settled or just have been displaced to, and to find out how the law sort of can be violent in different scenarios. You know, it might seem obvious that the Assad regime can be violent and has used the law violently in many ways, but possibly less obvious that, you know, the German state uses its, or the Australian state uses law in violent ways, but that can be the case in terms of its resettlement policies, or making people wait, you know, so long to find out whether they have been granted humanitarian visa and things like that. So only about 6 months into that project, but really excited to sort of go into some new literature. And so that's a new project, and that really kind of, it feels like it's sort of, in my head, it's all very much on a trajectory, but I don't know if for other people it looks like that anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does to me. Thank you for sharing that with us. They honestly sound really fascinating. So hopefully at least some of them become books, so we can have you back. But of course, in the meantime, while you're off working on the cool projects, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, again titled Redefining Ceasefires, Wartime Order and State Building in Syria, published by Cambridge University Press. Marika, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
So enjoyable. Thanks, Miranda. Really, really happy to do it.